Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The phrase driverless car may conjure images of the Jetsons, where commuters catch up with the news or TV while their car whisks them away to work, and they don't lift a finger. But technological advances are making self-driving automation a reality. And as the possibility of a self-driving car comes closer and closer, very real questions of how to regulate this technology are surfacing. Joining us today to talk about liability and driverless cars is John Villasenor. John is a senior fellow in governance studies in the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institute. He also teaches public policy and electrical engineering at UCLA. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
So automation in cars, it isn't new. We you know, there's anti-lock brakes. That happens automatically. What else is there about a car now that just occurs automatically?
Well, automation is really a spectrum, and it's got a very long history. All of us, of course, are familiar with cruise control, and that's really been around since the middle of the last century. There's also anti-lock brakes, which have been around for decades. There's electronic stability control, which when you press the brake can selectively apply the brakes to a subset of the wheels, you know, differentially, you know, depending on how slippery the road is and so on. So there's this long spectrum that really spans many decades of automation. What's new is the extent to which it's becoming possible to automate things. And I think many people have seen, you know, the Google videos from the Google self-driving car, where it's really going to become possible in the not-too-distant future to have cars do an enormous number of tasks that today are left to human drivers.
So when you're thinking of technologies like the self-driving car, is liability law something that immediately comes to mind? Is this something that is already being, are people already gnashing away on this somewhere?
Well, so certainly it's one of the things that comes up. It's a reasonable question. The question is, well, if something does go wrong, then, you know, how does that get handled from a liability standpoint? But I think it's important to take a step back and provide a little bit of context. First of all, vehicle autonomy, it offers the potential to really have an incredible safety benefit. In 2012, there were something like 33,000 motor vehicle fatalities in the United States, and an enormous fraction of those were due to, frankly, you know, human error, or in some, you know, basically carelessness or inattentiveness, or in some cases outright criminal negligence. So vehicle automation has an enormous potential to provide safety. That said, vehicle automation isn't going to be perfect, and there are going to be complex questions that sometimes arise if there are accidents. As very often, there are people who suggest that, well, gosh, we shouldn't really let any of this technology out onto the road until we've completely figured out in advance exactly how the liability is going to work. And I think what that view fails to recognize is that we actually have already a very robust product liability framework in this country based on the last half century of product liability litigation. And so there's really a good framework in place, and manufacturers already have a very strong incentive to make products as safe as possible, including autonomous vehicles.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is John Villasenor. He is a senior fellow in governance studies and the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institute. If you have a question or comment about self-driving cars and liability issues, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What's the potential difference between liability law for, say, a defective axle and something that has to do with automation? Is there?
Well, it's really, again, there's a whole product liability involves a whole bunch of different sort of what people call theories of liability. A product manufacturer can be accused of being negligent, for example, if they fail to exercise the proper degree of care when they're designing their products. Manufacturer can be accused of having a design defect if there's something defect that can cause harm, or a manufacturing defect, even if the design is sound, but due to some sort of a manufacturing error, when the product is made, it becomes it then has this mistake that causes harm. So all of these these frameworks for addressing product liability are applicable across a huge range of products, whether it's an axle or whether it's a home appliance or an automobile. And so these frameworks exist and have developed for many decades, and they will be equally applicable when it comes to autonomous vehicles.
How could liability, you're saying that we already have the liability framework in place to deal with potential issues, but so is there concern that liability laws could have an impact on, say, the innovation of driverless cars? It would preempt.
Well, actually, there is in the sense that there are some places, and there are some places where. I think it's also important to think to separate there's liability and then there's the laws that basically govern the operation of vehicles, just the regular vehicle codes in different states. And first and foremost, if we're going to spur the rollout of autonomous vehicles, it's going to be necessary for state legislatures to basically revise their motor vehicle operation laws to, obviously with proper attention to safety, make it possible for the testing and then eventually broader use of these. And the reason I mentioned this in answering your question is that there are some states where legislation has already been enacted. But in many states, or sometimes the dialogue gets stalled because people are unwilling to move forward with the laws allowing autonomous vehicles to be tested and rolled out unless there's also some specific attention to the liability issues. And because of that, sometimes the legislation has gotten stalled. And then the impact with that is that the entire industry gets stalled, and then all of those safety benefits that all of us stand to realize get pushed down the road farther. And that's not obviously a good thing.
What kind of legislation has been enacted in other states?
Well, there's a couple of states. The jurisdictions that I'm aware of where things have been enacted are California, Florida, Michigan, Nevada, and the District of Columbia. So that's four states in the District of Columbia to date. And mostly those, and of course there are variations among those different five different jurisdictions, but they address testing and to some extent operation and provide different. In some cases, they direct, for example, the motor vehicles or the legislature to develop rules by a certain date in the future. So it varies between the states, but at least most of them are promoting the testing of these vehicles with obviously some safeguards. You know, for example, that in some cases a person be able to take over control from the vehicle immediately as the need may arise, and so on.
Are there questions about when we look forward to an age of driverless cars where you won't have to be a certain age to operate a car anymore? I mean, are the people talking about things like that?
Well, I think, again, there's a spectrum, and one end of the spectrum is no automation at all, or then maybe something like just cruise control. And the other, the extreme end of the spectrum would be, as you mentioned when you're opening the segment, the Jetsons-type vision where you get in and you press a touchpad and, sit back and read a book on a tablet while it whisks you through rush hour traffic to work. And we are a long, long way from having that sort of technology be commercially, out there forever. I mean, that technology is maturing in the testing world, but we're a long way from having that be commercially applicable. So I think, first and foremost, we are, I would guess, decades away from commercial use at that level or with that level of advancement. And I guess beyond that, one might imagine, a future many, many years down the road where, the car could go pick up your 15-year-old from soccer practice without you in it. But I think it's going to be quite a long time before anything like that is possible.
When you talk about laws at promoting testing, laws at dealing with testing, is that laws permitting Google, for example, to test drive their cars on the roads?
For example, yes. I mean, as I'm sure all of your listeners know, motor vehicle laws, of course, have developed with this assumption that there's always a human being in control of the car, 100% of the time, and of course, driverless cars upend that assumption. And so, yes, that's exactly the kind of the manufacturers and the developers of these technologies. Obviously, they need to be able to bring them out on the road and test them, of course, with proper attention to safety. And so among the things that these people have pushed for is laws that will enable the the industry to advance through these testing procedures. So yes, that is one of the things that is addressed in some of these state laws.
Are these cars out on the roads now?
Next time you're on the road, if you look at the cars around you, the odds are very high that none of them will be autonomous. With the understanding that all of our cars have some level of autonomous technology these days, but this idea, the sort of the hands off the steering wheel autonomous, right? That's obviously something that is very, very unusual. But if you're in one of these states and you look at the right place, then I think I've seen here in California, I've seen the Google driverless car once or twice. But again, they're not common. But that presumably will change.
Finally, we've seen a lot of issues with technology surfacing, especially with car companies like General Motors recalling faulty and dangerous vehicles. Can you see recall issues increasing have they increased as our cars have become more complicated?
Interestingly, the advances in these technologies can, in some cases, take the recall out of recall, in the sense that to some extent it is possible, and I believe I remember reading, I'm not 100% sure, I believe I remember reading that this happened with that Tesla was able to update some software without actually requiring people to come in. So the idea of recalls, the autonomous vehicle technology makes it possible to update things without actually having people required to physically, go through the hassle of going into a dealership and, sitting around for a half hour, an hour while they do this. So that actually can provide a lot of increased convenience. These things always become more complicated because then you also obviously have to worry and make sure that nobody, there's a cybersecurity issue you have to be attentive to. You have to make sure that nobody can, download software onto your car while you're in it that might, that might not be the software you want. So that there needs to be proper attention to those issues as well.
Herb and Columbus, you're on the air with John Villasenor. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, this is Herb at Telt. I'm here in Columbus. And I would like to state a kind of a middle ground position. John was obviously for let's go with the automation and in advance even of corrective or constructive legislation. I would like to see where any proposed automated driving or automated vehicles be somehow vetted in advance and with careful, in totally impartial evaluation before they're let out loose on the road.
John, do you think that there's a chance of that, given?
Well, let me say that I'm in agreement with your listener that any of these technologies need to be properly vetted in advance. There's absolutely no question. The challenge then becomes how do you actually do that? I'll give you one example. In Nevada, the law created provides basically what would be a private technology certification market to demonstrate to basically certify the safety of these things. So Nevada has specifically thought about how you can actually the need for certification. So I think we would all agree that these technologies need to be properly tested and perhaps certified with some sort of an entity but there's various ways of doing that.
Okay. Herb, thanks a lot for the call. I'd like to thank you, John Villasenor, for joining us today.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
John Villasenor, he is a senior fellow in governance studies and the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institute. Coming up, more Tech Tuesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Moments after a tornado hit Arkansas recently, a journalist used a drone camera to capture stunning aerial videos and images of the damage. This sort of drone journalism has come under attack as the Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, says using drones for any sort of commercial purposes, including journalism, is not allowed. Critics of the ruling have First Amendment concerns and believe the value of information gathered in this way outweighs the potential harm. Joining us now is Pepperdine University Law Professor Greg McNeil. His work covers issues related to security, crime, and international affairs. He's also a regular contributor to Forbes magazine. Welcome, Greg.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Also with us from the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, is the founder of the Drone Journalism Lab, Matt Waite. Hi, Matt.
How you doing?
Thanks for joining us. Matt, just a beginning question of interest. When did journalists start using drone technology in their reporting? What kind of history do we have here?
Well, we don't have a lot, but we have a few examples going back to about 2010 is about where I can stretch it back, although you could extend the metaphor back to camera-mounted pigeons and people in hot air balloons going back to the 1700s. So there is a long history of journalists using aircraft. There is not a long history of journalists using unmanned aircraft. The first one that we can really trace back to is a now dearly departed online, actually iPad-only organization called The Daily. They hired a company to survey tornado damage in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and Joplin, Missouri, and we're pretty much immediately shut down by the FAA. But you've seen examples from around the world of protest coverage, of disasters, of all manner of things. I just talked to a reporter in El Salvador this last week, and they're using them to cover terrible traffic jams and pretty mundane things.
Greg, what is it about the Arkansas tornado footage and the what was just described there that Matt was talking about? What is it that the FAA finds objectionable?
So the FAA has long had a set of guidelines governing the use of remote control aircraft by hobbyists, so model airplanes, and for more than a decade now, they've basically said that when FAA regulations apply to aircraft, we're really talking about large manned aircraft, the typical types of airplanes that we would think of, and FAA regulations have heretofore not applied to model aircraft. And so all of that began to change recently when drones became more popular. So with the advancements in RC technology and navigational technology, even the advancements in cell phones that get GPS onto remote control airplanes, they've started to say that drones are something that the FAA is concerned with. And so they issued a statement a couple years ago basically making a distinction between drones that are used for hobbyist purposes and drones that are used for commercial purposes, with the FAA saying, if you fly a drone as your hobby, it's okay. We're not gonna come after you. But if you make some money flying that drone, well, then you're subject to all FAA regulations, and you need to have file a flight plan. You need to have certain safety certifications and checks that are completed. It's sort of an odd thing that they've done, because what they've said is that the FAA is mostly concerned with safety, but they're drawing their line not on safety lines, but instead on commercial use lines, which I think really exposes some First Amendment challenges.
Matt Waite, tell us about what you do at the Drone Journalism Lab and how you are responding to these challenges from the FAA.
Well, we originally began with the idea that we were going to explore both the practical aspects of this, you know, what kind of devices were out there, what could they do, how high could they go, how far could they go, what kind of cameras could they carry, and, you know, what kind of stories could you do. And we were going to simultaneously be looking at the kind of legal and ethical problems that were raised with them and the kind of questions that newsrooms were going to have to grapple with if they were going to use these. And we thought that originally we could do this using these hobbyist rules because we're an educational institution. We have no commercial interest in what we're doing. And also, you know, we weren't doing research and development on how to build the better drone. We were just using them to get some pictures. And the FAA sent us a letter last July telling us that we had to stop doing what we were doing, which kind of puts a crimp in things, to say the least. So we've been focusing mostly on kind of ethical and legal questions since then, but we've also been working on getting what's called a certificate of authorization from the FAA. I work at a state institution, the University of Nebraska, as a public entity, and because of that, the FAA says we can apply for their certificates of authorization. Now, that might give us an ability to get back in the air outside and use these without having to really worry about the FAA coming after us. But to be clear, they're anathema to journalism. They require you to file paperwork, a pretty substantial amount of paperwork, as far as 60 business days in advance of getting the permit. You have to file for a specific piece of property. You can only fly to a certain altitude that you have to specify in advance, which pretty much precludes us from covering any kind of breaking news. We would have to figure out a news event at a specific location 60 business days in advance, which I kind of half joke with people that if you can do that, if you can figure out a breaking news event at a specific location that far in advance, we need to talk about business opportunities and forget this journalism stuff. So that's what we're doing. Because we're a state institution, we have a responsibility to follow the rules, whatever they may be. But we're also treating it as an investigative reporting project. We have an opportunity to go through this process where others don't, and we can report on it openly and disclose what the paperwork looks like and what the questions that we're getting are, and we can post those openly on the internet. And we are indeed doing that.
Greg McNeil, how is the FAA responding to claims that these laws are, you know, could be in violation of the First Amendment right to free speech?
Well, what's interesting is that the FAA and now the National Park Service have dug their heels in. So there was a photographer, videographer by the name of Perker, who flew his drone to gather footage. The most notable case he's known for is that he conducted some video flights over the University of Virginia's campus, and a less well-known one that was just recently written about at the Motherboard Vice website by a journalist named Jason Kubler was Perker's earlier run-in with the Park Service. Both agencies have said that drones are governed by laws that regulate aircraft, even when those laws that regulate aircraft, for example, the Park Service's laws specifically say that aircraft are only manned aircraft, not unmanned aircraft. Both services have said that both agencies have said that these are regulated and therefore prohibited. The FAA is saying this and continuing to go after people, despite the fact that a National Transportation Safety Board judge reviewed the case against Perker, looked at the case and said, no, you guys all along, FAA, have said that aircraft are manned aircraft and remote control aircraft drones are outside of your regulations. You can't all of a sudden now, after a decade of non-enforcement, start going after people. And so the judge smacked down the FAA's interpretation of the law. And despite smacking them down, the FAA has decided to appeal. And during their appeal, they're continuing to threaten people with substantial fines for flying drones for commercial purposes. It's almost absurd.
Do they have similar objections to, say, if I got in an air balloon and floated over something to report on it, would that be a problem too?
No, and that's the crazy thing about this. So you take the Arkansas footage. If the individual in Arkansas who had his GoPro camera connected to a drone had instead been in a helicopter, that would have been okay. If he had hopped in a hot air balloon and conducted the same surveillance, the same footage and news gathering, that would have been okay. If he you know, put the camera on a 10-foot pole and stuck it overhead as he drove around, that would be okay. But because he used a remote control helicopter to gather the footage, the FAA has said they're looking into the incident. And what that basically means is it sends a message to other journalists. You might face a $10,000 fine if you don't give in to the FAA's interpretation of the law, an interpretation that a judge just struck down.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the use of drones for journalism. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Matt, what are some of the advantages of using drones in journalism, and how could they change the way journalists work?
The first argument, and the most powerful one, I think, for a lot of newsrooms is the economic argument. These things are really inexpensive. You can spend just $1,000 to a few thousand dollars. I mean, not to sound like a used car salesman, but I can find a drone that fits your budget. For $1,000 or a few thousand dollars, you can have cinema grade, high quality video from an aerial platform. Renting a helicopter, a manned helicopter, will cost you that much or more per hour.
Mm-hmm.
The helicopters that local television stations have, the traffic helicopters, that's a $4 to $6 million aircraft off the lot. And that's not even talking about the high six figures to low seven figures that it costs to operate and maintain that every year. So this is a way for a lot more news organizations to be able to get images, video, data, those kinds of things from the air. So it would allow for the public to get airborne images of an event that would help them understand things. And I think that's where the real power lies, is that these events that we're talking about, so disasters, floods, droughts, environmental degradation, those kinds of things, it's often very, very difficult to kind of wrap your mind around how big it is or how bad it is unless you get up in the air a little bit. And even just a few hundred feet in the air will give you a pretty significant dose of perspective on these mm-hmm. events. So that news organizations will be able to do it more, they will be able to provide people more perspective, and they'll be able to do it at a vastly reduced cost is the real power here.
Greg McNeil, I saw. Sure. Go ahead.
I was going to just jump in there. I mean, the point Matt is making is really pretty substantial. I mean, there was a drone hobbyist in Texas who was just flying his drone around taking imagery, and what he saw from about 150 feet above the ground that others didn't see from ground level was that there was a meatpacking plant that was dumping the blood of the meat that it was packing directly into a river. And so this is the type of thing that with a device for just a couple hundred dollars that he was flying, we were able to find the environmental impact of a plant. And so you could see that how governments would want to use this for inspections. So instead of sending out an inspector to go to 20 different places on a river to check the river, you could have a drone go out and in a matter of minutes instead of a matter of days or hours, check for environmental impact from various plants and whatnot. And what's really interesting is that the state of Texas responded to that by basically prohibiting the type of use that right. citizen had done. Basically, the big industry interests and the privacy interests won out over the public interest to protect the environment.
Janice in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Janice.
Hi, how are you doing? Here's my question and point. First of all, I believe helicopters and balloons, there's some kind of regulation on how they fly, where they fly, and whatever for public safety. And I think drones need something, too, just as a person who's in an airplane every now and then, seeing something whizzing around, or maybe like a bird getting caught in the engine or something. It could be very dangerous. The second thing is, how are you going to use these things to cover journalism? Journalism seems to be going down the toilet, no offense, into areas where the most vicious shark attack or blonde getting captured or kidnapped or whatever. It has replaced any looking at substance. Are you going to use these drones to follow somebody down the street and see what kind of an affair they have? Or
okay.
more on the fire down the street?
Well,
or more
okay.
on the car crash?
Well, let's, hey, Janice. Okay, great, great.
Bye.
Thank you, Janice. Thanks a lot. So kind of two issues there. One is the safety issue. Shouldn't drones be regulated to avoid colliding with other moving objects in the air? And then two is the privacy issue you mentioned earlier, Greg McNeil. But Matt, wait, first of all, I mean, could you address what Janice was talking about generally about? Is this going to become something that you use to follow people around and harass them?
Well, there's two things. One, I don't believe anybody who wants to use these devices, and this cuts across all industries, believes that it should be a free-for-all. there really does need to be some set of guidelines here. There need to be some safety rules. There need to be some restrictions, quite honestly, that that will allow for commercial use, that will allow for the technology to be used for what it could be used for, but done so safely. These things, they do crash. They can hurt people. They could interfere with aircraft in the air, although I believe that that is overblown. The worry is not so much the other aircraft in the air. It's honestly the people on the ground that present the bigger safety issue. And for that reason alone, there absolutely needs to be a set of rules that both allow this to go on, but also ensures that we can all be safe on the ground and also in the air. So there absolutely does need to be that. In terms of the paparazzi stalker and things like that, I recognize that that concerns people, but honestly, I think that too is overblown. Once you realize that these devices fly for about 8 to 15 minutes, that's about how long the batteries are going to last. And that includes the time it takes to get to where you need to be and to the altitude that you need to be, and also includes the time that you need to come back. So the thing I always tell people is that if you think you're going to stalk Lindsay Lohan with one of these things, you best have a pickup truck full of batteries. Because you're going to be going up and coming down and going up and coming down and changing the batteries over and over and over again. Honestly, it's just not practical to follow people around. That's not to say that maybe someday in the future the batteries won't get solved, but we have laws on the books. Almost all states have laws on the books. We have common law going back hundreds of years that that makes violations of privacy, that makes intrusion upon seclusion actionable in civil court, and puts a pretty significant risk for the operator to go and do things that I would call stupid. Honestly, to her criticism of journalism struggling right now, I hear what she's saying, but honestly, I think this is an opportunity to add to the credibility of the news report, to show people something going on, not necessarily, you know, affairs and things like that. And as I said, I think it's really just impractical and honestly actionable and probably even criminally actionable. But there are ways that these could be used to help improve the news report, and I think that passing laws that would make things illegal, like Texas has done, doesn't serve anyone, and in fact infringes upon free speech rights that are pretty well established.
Yeah, and if you don't mind, I think the points that Matt is making, especially the point about how most of us who support this technology are not opposed to rules to govern it for safety purposes, is really the most important part of this debate. What legislatures are doing, what the Park Service and the FAA are doing, is they're just simply banning these devices, and the FAA and the Park Service are doing it without even following the law that requires them to post regulations for public comment.
Well, what do you make of that, Greg? Why do you think they're doing that? Why is this such something that they're...
This is what bureaucracies and government agencies do when they face a problem. They feel like they need to act quickly to address the problem. And the challenge with that is that while we want them to act quickly to address the problem, we also want them to open up their rules and comments for their rules for public commentary so that the public could have input on things. So if you think about what is a drone, how about just what is a drone? Is it the thing that you buy at the remote control helicopter that you buy at the mall, mm-hmm. or is it something much larger? That should be in a rule somewhere. So if I go to a park and my daughter flies a remote control helicopter, I don't have to worry about her facing what the Park Service says is 6 months in jail and a $5,000 fine. Mm. And so we have a process in place in this country that says when agencies promulgate regulations, they're supposed to put them up for public comment. They're supposed to take those public comments under consideration and then promulgate rules. And by doing that, what you might find are there are certain uses that we would consider legitimate, journalistic uses and others, and there are certain uses that would be off the table. There might be certain practices like following people or in a park following animals mm-hmm. that we would want to prohibit and other things that we might want to allow. And so the big problem here is that these government agencies are acting in an almost lawless fashion. They're not allowing for public commentary on their regulations. And that's their responsibility as under the delegated authority that Congress has given them.
Greg McNeil, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Greg McNeil, he's a professor of law and public policy at Pepperdine University. And Matt Waite, director of the Drone Journalism Lab at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Thanks to you as well.
It's my pleasure.
Tech Tuesday continues when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. Ann Fisher here. When Microsoft launched their Kinect sensor, it was intended to bring more dynamic and interactive elements to gaming. But the company continues to develop other applications for its motion sensor technology. Joining us to discuss the Kinect keyboard and other tech news is Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. Welcome back, Russell.
Thanks.
So is this a kind of keyboard with motion sensors where you could just wave your hands around it?
That's the general idea. This is something that has been a long time coming. I really hope that this becomes a big deal soon, because the coolest thing that most people saw when they interfaced with the Kinect was that it was good for games and stuff. But Microsoft built this entire operating system that is supposed to be mostly touch friendly, and then installed it on a bunch of things that have regular mice and keyboards and no touch screens.
Mm-hmm.
This seems like a really great way to kind of cross that bridge and give people who aren't ready to move to a tablet or who have a desktop like I do, some touch-friendly options. And they do this, the concept here is to take all of these sensors and embed them in the keyboard itself, so that when you put your hands over the keyboard and move it around, you're interfacing directly with the computer without having to touch any buttons or anything.
What's wrong with touching buttons?
There's nothing wrong with touching buttons when you are writing an email or doing something like that. But if we've learned anything from the last couple of years of using, iPads and smartphones, is that the idea behind touch and eye control and hand control is that it gives us more flexibility. It's all about less motion to accomplish more tasks.
I'm talking with Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. We're talking about the Microsoft Kinect keyboard. It's developing a new keyboard with motion sensors. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. If you have any tech question for Russell, you're welcome to give it a shot. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. So Microsoft launched the Kinect sensor for his Xbox 360. What other uses did people find for the sensor?
So a ton of stuff. There's a Kinect for PC sensor that came out at the same time, and there's a newer version that's been released with the Xbox One that included a new PC variant sensor. And there have been so many do-it-yourself special projects that have come from this. There was a train car that had a display that was mounted for a projector that allowed you to interact with the window itself as though it were a display. There was this really funny looking trash can that would track the movement of something that you threw. So like you had a piece of paper and you would crumple it up and throw it into the air. The trash can would actually use the Kinect to wirelessly move to catch the piece of paper that you threw in the air.
That's kind of freaky.
It was definitely freaky. And it's all of these kind of little one-off projects that came the videos that get made are so incredibly cool. And that's all the result of this Kinect sensor, because it takes so many different kinds of pictures at the same time that it allows for kind of this new level of inexpensive computer vision that makes it so that, robotics and simple programs are just way more aware of the environment that you're sitting in.
You know, we were talking about driverless cars, and I would imagine this kind of sensors would be a big deal in driverless cars.
It ends up being a separate level of computer vision for things like driverless cars, especially the ones that Google's using. There's this huge dish that's sitting on top that allows it to see through radar and things like that over a much broader range than something like a couple of cameras would be able to interact with. But it's not dissimilar from some of the speed control systems that we have right now that allow cars with automatic drive modes to match the speed of the vehicle in front of it.
Mm-hmm. What kinds? Now you said that there's the waste basket where you can actually throw a piece of paper, you know, crunched up piece of paper at it, and it can sense that and move to where the paper's going. What other kinds of motions can the keyboard sense, or can this technology sense?
The idea here is to give control over kind of basic gestures. So while the trash can example is something of, you know, the entire environment around you, the idea here for the keyboard gives you simple pinch to zoom control on your screen, or you know, tapping something on your screen just by poking your finger out over where it would be on the display, and of course, you know, swiping your hand back and forth to scroll. It's less about removing the need for a keyboard and more about removing the need for the mouse by giving you just the ability, instead of having to go from, you know, both hands on the keyboard,
gotcha,
to you know, reaching over and grab a mouse, to be able to just lift both hands up and get that control.
Okay, so they haven't said if they're going to mass produce the product. What do you think are the chances are that they will? Where do you think see this headed?
I think that Microsoft moved pretty quickly once they saw competition in the space from companies like Leap Motion, who had started embedding their sensors in HP's laptops and a couple of other devices that are offering kind of similar motion control. And Intel has worked pretty hard on doing things with eye tracking that we'll probably see later this year. So I think that this is something that Microsoft, if they can get, you know, to an acceptable price range, we'll probably end up seeing later this year.
What makes Microsoft, I'm not sure you said it, but is Microsoft better than the others? And it's just a matter of being able to market it and produce it at a price point people can afford? Or is Microsoft...
Definitely a big part of it, but I think Microsoft just has a large enough research firm already dedicated to this technology, and there's so much research that they've already done into Kinect that accuracy is something that they've got a much better grasp on.
Okay, so you wanted to talk about a wooden camera necklace.
This was the weirdest thing. I sent it hoping that we'd have a couple minutes to talk about it. There is a woman who sells these necklaces on Etsy that look like just regular wooden cameras, like a DSLR camera that is on a necklace. It's just this very kind of nerdy looking piece of wood that hangs on a chain. But it turns out that it is actually a camera. The woman has taken a small camera, just a pinhole camera with a couple of really basic functions, and actually carved the wood so that the camera fits in between the two pieces. And the end result is a camera that hangs on your neck that can take 720p video and a bunch of basic photos, and actually has removable storage so that you can take the photos that you've taken and move them to a computer or something without a whole lot of effort.
How big is it?
It's not too much bigger than a pair, $2.50. It's just this really simple design that hangs on a chain. And the camera itself is obviously even smaller. And it's not like, there are a couple of life logging cameras that are, you know, constantly taking pictures as you walk around. And I think that those are a little on the creepy side. This actually requires pushing button on the back of the piece of wood to take a picture. It doesn't make it any more obvious that you're taking a picture, because, you know, it could just be someone playing with their necklace. But it's definitely interesting that we've reached a point where cameras are that small and the technology to, you know, to incorporate them is so basic that, you know, almost anything could, you know, potentially have a camera in it like this.
Is she an artist designer, or is she a technology person? Where is she coming from?
Her name is Lydia Barr, and it was really just a project that she started initially for her grandmother, and it turned into so many people wanting to get a copy of it that she started selling them for $150 on Etsy.
Did you buy one?
I did not buy one. I have plenty of cameras in my life, and I don't know that wood would really do well around my neck. I'm not really a style guy, so I don't know. But.
Well, we've talked about how wearable technology is the thing of the future.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, this is a little basic as far as wearable technology goes, mm-hmm. but it is certainly a perfect example of how, you know, there are so many different directions that this technology is going in right now.
If anyone has any questions for Russell Holley, get them in. We got a couple minutes, 614-292-8513. Don't wait. You wanted to talk about Disney Infinity 2.0 and how it's and its plans to incorporate Marvel comic heroes. First, about what is Disney Infinity?
So Disney Infinity is a game for almost everything. You know, all the major consoles, there's a PC activities that you can do. I think that there's even some smartphone accessories that go along with it. And it is, Disney made this kind of digital toy box where you've got these toys that you put on a physical platform next to your television, and it takes that character and puts them in the game for you to go around and play and do things with. And we've seen this kind of basic setup before with Skylanders, but these are all of Disney's intellectual property. So, you know, there's a huge set of collectibles now that you can go and purchase that are specifically these Disney characters that you can go and interact with this game. So every time a new movie comes out or something like that from Disney, there are these figurines that go along with it. So from a collector's standpoint, Disney really made sure that they got a ton of money out of this. But their next version of the game is coming out to the Xbox One and PlayStation 4 and all of the new consoles. And with it is going to come the Marvel Avengers line and a whole lot more content.
So other than a whole lot more content, like what?
So the idea behind Disney Infinity is that you've got this toy box full of characters that you kind of build your own world and have them play in. But then each one of the characters has their own world that they can go off to and play games in and, you know, complete objectives. So you've got the Avengers is going to have the world that, you know, the Avengers come in. So you've got New York, basically. It's kind of a loose adaptation of New York with Stark Tower and Iron Man and all of these things. And it ends up being the biggest of the cities that they've built so far for the characters to go and do things in. And it comes with a ton of, you know, games and missions that are exclusive to the Avengers. So you've got, you know, Captain America and Hulk and Hawkeye and these characters, and you put them in the city and have them go and complete these objectives. And then when they're done, they can come back to the kind of central toy box world that you've built and go back to interacting with the characters that you've put in there.
What age group is this geared toward?
It ends up being a much younger audience for the most part. Skylanders kind of attracted an older audience because there was this kind of overarching plot and a game that you could complete. But Disney Infinity is definitely targeted, I think, you know, 6 to 10, maybe a little younger, maybe a little older. And the figurines are all, you know, kind of styled in the same art form that you see for a lot of the Disney TV shows that are out today.
And what devices is it available for, or consoles?
The current version of Disney Infinity is available for all of the consoles, as well as a PC version and a mobile app that goes along with the game. But the Disney Infinity 2.0 is going to cover all of those consoles, as well as the new ones, so the Xbox One and the PlayStation 4.
We have a quick email from Mike. He says, smartphones keep getting bigger and bigger for some reason. I like the size of the newest iPhones, but want to stay with Android. What are your recommendations?
So the Moto X is something that is pretty close in line with the current iPhone, and that's a reasonably new phone. There aren't a ton. Everyone is getting bigger screens, that is absolutely right, including Apple. There's a lot of rumors that say mm-hmm. that the next version of the iPhone is going to be even larger. But the Moto X is definitely the best of the phones that are in that size for right now.
Russell Holley, thank you so much for joining us as usual.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holley, he's tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks to the Allside staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Julia Hyder, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks so much for listening to us today on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.